You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon, and I'm live in York. At the UK Championship. A lot has happened since we last gathered together. Mark Allen won the Champion of Champions with a very, very impressive display in the final against Judd Trump, 10-3. We had the UK Championship qualifying, which hopefully you followed on YouTube and Facebook and Discovery Plus, the drama of Judgment Day. That was a very intense few days. And now we're into the main event, the UK Championship itself at the Barbican in York. In the meantime, Ronnie O'Sullivan has had a film come out as well. And all this will be discussed in due course. And there's so much to discuss that there'll be two podcasts this week. This one, I've got 45 minutes to do this one before I've got to go and commentate again this evening. So I'm doing this between sessions, 45 minutes, and then that's the cut-off. So we've been very kind to send your UK Championship memories, which is what I asked for a few weeks ago. So we're going to go through as many of those as possible. Then all the other business we'll discuss later in the week at a time to be decided, probably by how long the actual snooker is. So that's what's happening this week. That's the bill of fare, the order of play. But before that, we have had a little bit of follow-up about various matters. And we're going to start with the Champion of Champions, because we like to hear people who've been to the snooker and have been to various venues. Champion of Champions Bolton at the White's Hotel. It's actually called the Tough Sheet Stadium, which in itself is you're basically risking the end of your career trying to say that. I didn't say it once on ITV, but anyway, Sean Robinson has been to the tournament, and this is what he says. He says, "Quick email regarding Champion of Champions. I attended the night session on Thursday. Sean Murphy, Judd Trump. That was a great game, by the way." So he's got pros and cons. He says the pros: I thought Bolton is still a good venue. It's fairly accessible. I think it should stay for the foreseeable. The ticket prices were reasonable. It was a great atmosphere. Temperature inside was bang on. Sometimes it can be either too cold or too hot. Format of the groups during the day, I think, works okay, unless you play second and finish late. Yeah, of course, most of the matches in the evening seem to be won. I think possibly all of them were won by the player who played first. And Sean says the cons. He says, as with most venues now, the drinks and food are ridiculous, but I suppose that's the venue, not World Snooker Tour. I would jump in there, Sean. Of course, it's a matchroom event. But anyway, yes, the venue would definitely set the prices anyway. He says, the seats seem to be getting closer and closer, slightly claustrophobic, to be fair. He says, the merchandise is okay at best. It was similar to the Players' Championship I went to last year. Nothing to write home about. Overall, another great night out, to which I took my son with me for the first live event. First game, first frame, and Sean makes a century. He was amazed and loved the night also. He's also not content to tell us that. Sean has come in with another subject, which is benign meetings with snooker players. This is a subject we've been doing for a number of months. Other podcasters have been doing it as well, but we started it. I'm going to continue with it. He says, my one is from the Players' Championship in Wolverhampton earlier this year. I was at the semi-final on the Saturday, Sean Murphy again. Earlier in the day, I was shopping, as you do in the town centre. As I'm gliding down the escalator, like in a scene from a Hollywood rom-com, going up the escalator in the opposite direction, also like something from a Hollywood rom-com, was the captain himself, Ali Carter. I nodded my head in appreciation and just spouted the word Ali, to which he nodded back in the same level of appreciation. Anyway, to say this was where the rom-com ended is an understatement, but I thought it was a nice gesture anyway. I can hear the tumbleweeds already. Well, not at all. That's exactly what we're looking for. if no words are basically spoken other than the name of the player, that's bang on, I think, Sean. Thank you very much for your email. What I'm going to do, and we're nothing if not, you know, spontaneous, I'm actually going to go... I'm going to save some of the other emails to the end, because what I realise is if I do the UK Championship memories and we still have time, we can squeeze some other emails in at the end. If we don't, they'll roll on to later in the week. So Declan writes... It's late November, and one of the comforting certainties of the sporting calendar is that the UK Snooker Championship is starting. A standout memory of the UK Championship for me comes from a classic last 16 match from 1985, where Alex Higgins took on Jimmy White at the Preston Guildhall. This was 3 years on from their classic semi-final at the Crucible, and the two players seemed to be in a mood to entertain all and sundry. This was a case of two gunslingers going at it, and each player seemed to fend off the others. Extravagance at the table. I guess, given the sponsor, Declan, you could maybe call it the gunfight at the UK Coral, and that's quite a clever joke. Cleverer than the jokes we used to have in the much missed section. Anyway, we'll continue with Declan's email. Apologies for interrupting. He says there were several standout shots in this, but one in particular is edged in the memory. As Higgins was going into the mid-session interval, 3-1 up, he finished clearing up with an outrageous long half ball black into the bottom left-hand pocket. Higgins blasted at the black and missed it in the jaws, only for the black to hop up at speed onto the left-hand side rail and proceed smoothly down the cushion, finally dropping into the left-hand middle pocket. "I've seen it all now," exclaimed Clive Everton on commentary. "The match is on YouTube and worth checking out for some of the special shot-making on display. I had a 6x3 table at home at this time, and for months afterwards I tried to replicate this shot. Naturally, this was a tough assignment, and thinking back, I might have been a better club player if I'd stuck to simple, basic, plain ball striking instead of attempting to replicate the second most famous shot from the 1985 UK Championship. A misspent youth indeed." And Declan there, yes, the second most famous, of course, I'm sure you mean the most famous was Willie Thorne's Miss Blue in the final. I think it's interesting, Declan, actually, there, and thanks for the email. The amount of people Alex Higgins inspired is, you know, incalculable, but... how many of them actually tried to play like him? Because if you were teaching someone to play snooker, you would not teach that sort of outrageous style of play. You would teach the Steve Davis method, the reliable method. If you try and play like Alex, you know, you may not get too far. But anyway, thank you for the email. John in Bishop Stortford. He says, "I hope this finds you well. I wanted to write in following your request for listeners to share their memories of the UK Championship. I first attended the event in 2019. And watched the semi-final match between Stephen Maguire and Mark Allen, which Stephen won 6-0 in what must be one of the most dominant displays in the best of 11. As I'm writing this, it's made me wonder where indeed this ranks. And the only other comparison match that springs to mind is when Ronnie O'Sullivan beat Ricky Walden 6-0 at the Masters in 2014. When I checked Q-Tracker, Ronnie scored a total of 557 points in that match versus Stephen's total of 548. Where a player wins 6-0 in a best of 11, can you or any of your listeners find any other matches that rival this number of points scored by the winner? This year will be the third time I attend the UK Championship. I can't wait, travelling up on the Saturday to watch the evening semi-final match and both sessions of the final before coming back home on the Monday. One question, I have an earpiece from this year's World Championship. Will it work in York, even if I replace the battery?" I think the answer to that, John, is no. From what we've heard from other correspondents, I think you may have to buy a new one. I don't want to say that with too much certainty in case you waste your money, but I'm pretty sure other people have said that that you have to buy a new earpiece, which I know some people are annoyed about, but that's the way of the world, I guess. In terms of the scoring you mentioned there, the one-sided nature of that match, well, we had the points out reply record set in that match, Ronnie O'Sullivan against Ricky Walden, 556. In any match, that's the record without opponent replying. So I guess for that reason, that has to count as the most dominant display we've ever seen in a best of 11. Now, Ian Homerston, he says, "One match that always comes to mind when the UK Championship comes around is Stephen Hendry losing 9-0 to Marcus Campbell in 1998. I'm not sure it's quite accurate to say I remember the match as it happened on the pre-televised stages, so I've never seen a single shot from it. But I think this is partly what makes it such an incredible moment, the fact that hardly anyone saw it happen, only adding to the unreal quality. Similar, I suppose, to Jamie Burnett's 1-4-8 break, which also occurred at the UK Championship, albeit the qualifying rounds. I was actually there for Hendry Campbell, and I remember, yeah, it wasn't televised, So in the press room, we would have like the score monitor on the screen, and I remember 4-0 at the interval, and people were raised eyebrows, certainly, but you think, well, it's a best of 17, Hendry will turn it round. 5 or 6-0, you start to think, wow, this is huge. And obviously, it then ends at 8-0, and it's actually an overnight position, because it was good. They were going to come back for the final session, and you turn out the final frame the next day. And at that point, you're already writing the story that Hendry's out. It's just a question of how heavy the defeat is. But 9-0, an extraordinary result, and of course, it did cause him to go back to the drawing board with his game, and later that season, he won his 7th world title. Ian's not done yet. He says, on the subject of Hendry Campbell, the next meeting, according to Q-Tracker, was the 2009 Shanghai Masters. Campbell was on the brink of whitewashing Hendry again as he went 4-0 up before Hendry came back to win 5-4. The only other match between them seems to have been the 1998 Scottish Open, where Campbell also won. Here, I think Q-Tracker may have the frame scores wrong, as they don't seem to tally with the match result. However, a Herald Scotland match report from the time says Campbell came back from 4-2 down to win 5-4. If this is the case, it means Campbell will have won 16 frames in a row against Hendry across the three matches, which is surely a record for most consecutive frames won against the great man. Well, that's an extraordinary thing to dig out there, Ian, and you may well be right. I've not delved back through all the records to say with any certainty that that's right, but there's a good chance, I would say. So thank you for delving that out for us. Phil Spivey, a regular correspondent, he says, the UK Championship's almost upon us. I've got the week off work. I'm preparing to settle down for a great week of snooker. That's the way to do it, Phil. He says, you asked for memories of the tournament. There are so many, but here are just a few of mine. The 1987 final between Steve Davis and Jimmy White, 16-14 to Davis, possibly the first one I watched, and the standard throughout was incredible. I checked Q-Tracker, which shows Davis as having made 5 centuries, scoring which would be pretty impressive today, along with lots of other half-centuries from both players. It's important to remember how good Davis was at potting and scoring, and how he could adapt his game to beat his opponent regardless of their style. That match is, to some extent, one of the forgotten classics, rarely mentioned nowadays. Then Davis's run to the 2005 final was brilliant. I was desperate for him to win the title, but it wasn't to be. One of my favourite narratives in any sport is a great but past their very best champion enjoying an Indian summer. Interestingly, Davis was 48 at the time, and his run to the final considered a big surprise. Yet if any of the class of 92 reached the final, or even won the UK title this year, none of us would be particularly shocked. Not sure what that means, really, but I think it is quite interesting. But Ding was mightily impressive in victory, and I really thought he'd go on to dominate and win multiple world titles. At 18, he seemed the complete player. Can't quite believe he's not yet become world champion. Finally, Stephen Maguire's performance against Mark Allen. This is, again, another shout for this in the 2019 semi-final. He was unplayable, with big breaks in every frame. I've no idea he'll win this time, which is the beauty of modern snooker. For some reason, I fancy Selby, but that is perhaps more to do with him being due a UK title than anything else. It's wide open. Who is your tip? Well, we're partway through. Thanks, Phil. We're partly through the tournament, so it's kind of easy now to sort of not tip the people already out. I did have a slight, I don't know why, I had a slight feeling for Mark Williams, and there was no reason for it. I was looking down the obvious contenders. I mean, Mark Allen was one. Of course, he's out. Judd Trump has got through. We get to see, at the time of recording, Ronnie O'Sullivan or John Higgins. I thought Barry Hawkins had a good chance this year, but of course he, as I record this, he's still playing against Ben Williston. It's wide open. I'll say this, though, and it's easy to say, I know, but I think it will be won by one of the top 16. There's been upsets already, some of the qualifiers getting through. It's asking so much to beat not only one top player, but then another and another and another and another to win the title. So it's probably going to be kind of one of the usual suspects. Selby's a good shout, possibly. We'll see. By the time you listen to this podcast, he may be out. We don't know. Now, Alpha Bonzi has also got in contact with the UK Championship memories. He says, despite the slightly uninspiring sponsor, it's still the game's second greatest event. It's one in the eye for Mr. Q, isn't it? He says, I've tried to narrow it down to three. 2001, my first as a proper snooker fan, and in the run-up to my GCSEs, I therefore had to follow it from afar until the Sunday final. And I finally got the TV to myself and watched surprised as O'Sullivan won 10-1 without really having to be at his best. A bad night for Ken Doherty and the BBC, who had to fill time after a short second session. I remember I was in the pub by about 8:30 there. That's by the way, speaking of which, and all the excitement last night, the fire alarm at the Barbican. We were just about to start the evening session. Funnily enough, our commentary position is quite high up in the Barbican. I was walking up into the foyer. You go through the public foyer, and you could smell smoke. And people were sort of saying, "Oh, yeah, you know, it's a bit of smell of smoke." And I think people were wondering, was it like a smoke machine? Were they trying to make an atmospheric thing No, it turned out there was a fire. There was actually a small electrical fire. Now, as luck would have it, the fire station is right across the road from the venue. So the fire people didn't have far to travel. We were all evacuated. But here's the thing, the sort of snooker people, the players, the media, the officials, you know, the TV crew, we all had to go to the local pub. The Edinburgh Arms, which is a well-known pub in these parts where snooker people go. And we had to wait there. I've never seen so many people from the snooker circuit in a pub without buying a drink. All the sort of people you'd expect to have a few pints down them obviously couldn't do that because they were working. There was one poor chap who actually came along to watch the darts on the telly, you know, unassuming. Suddenly, there's Hussein Bafai, there's Stephen Hendry and Dennis Taylor and Steve Davis and Sean Murphy and all these people. Anyway, it wasn't too long. We were back in. The staff of the Barbican and the World Snooker Tour security staff did a brilliant job just shepherding everybody out very calmly, keeping everybody safe. You know, they are trained for sort of major incidents. And they played a blinder, so I wanted to credit them and obviously the emergency services as well for the great job they did. But anyway, that was the excitement last night. Of course, it meant an 8 o'clock start, which meant a late finish, but these things can't be helped. Alpha Bonzi is continuing here. Number two, 2011. Being at a loose end in life at the time, I was looking forward to another week of best of 17s until the news came through that we were now going to be best of 11. I was even more puzzled after the promises of now being able to show finishes to every match on every scheduled session, that just into the deciding frame of the Trumbo-Sullivan last 16 match, the BBC came off to show an antiques programme. Well, spoiler alert, I think Trump won that match because he won the tournament. Here's the thing about, people still say it should be best of 17, which I understand, but actually you get more snooker in best of 11s. You know, most matches we've seen already are quite long. You're going to get maybe, you know, at least 9, possibly 10 frames. Best of 17, you'll get 8 frames in the first session, and if it's a runaway, you might get 4 or 5 at night. So actually, best of 11, you get to see more snooker. You get to see a finish every session. Now, whether the length should increase towards the end, that's an argument. But again, you know, BBC One will be showing the afternoon semi-final on Saturday. Would they want to show just an 8-frame start on BBC One? I don't think so. They want to show the end. So that's the kind of push-pull. All I can say is it's been full, so the public seem to be enjoying it. I used to like the best of 17s, but I'm not going to be, you know, joining marches in the street to get them back. I quite like this format now. 2021, Alpha says, not being able to watch much of the week's action due to work commitment. We've got a sort of trajectory of Alpha's life here. We've gone from his school exams to being frankly listless, it seems, to now having a job. So it's a feel-good story. He says, having not been able to watch much of the week's action due to work commitments, my final day before I left that job coincided with my birthday in the Karen Wilson, Ronnie O'Sullivan quarter final. That was a great match, by the way. He says, which I was able to catch the last couple of frames of after being let off early with a tin of sweets as my farewell present. So, in fact, he leaves the job there. That's a twist, isn't it? I didn't see coming. Hopefully you're in gainful employment now, Alpha, and thank you, as ever, for the email. I actually thought there were more emails on the UK Championship, but I may have mislaid some. Which wouldn't be a first, but if I find them again, we'll return to them. But in the meantime, we will move on to other things, and maybe come back to this later if I can. If I can find the emails, I'm sure there were more. So if you haven't read yours out, then apologies. We'll move on to John Hill. He says, just a quick note regarding the state of official merchandise on offer from World Snooker Tour. I believe snooker lends itself naturally to merchandising of various sorts due to its distinctive colours and the triangle of red setup. However, World Snooker Tour doesn't seem to be taking advantage of this. It would be an easy place to start with various products, foam covers, stationery, bottles, mugs, clothing, etc., in each of the distinctive snooker colours. As for the online store, well, it looks amateur at best, and the amount of products on offer is woefully poor. I'm hopeful that the promised changes are coming with the new people starting within WST, and this is just another area that needs a drastic upgrade. Thank you, John. I suppose that the virtue of the colour balls is you could collect a set of something. I don't know what exactly, maybe beer mats or, you know, fridge magnets in each of the colours, I don't know. I had a look today at the merchandise stand at the Barbican, which seems a little more sort of stuffed with things than maybe some previous ones I've seen. You know, the only problem is, I mean, I looked at the sort of clothing range, all with WST branding on. Now, with the best will in the world, I don't know how many people really want to buy a T-shirt with the logo of World Snooker Tour on. They might want to buy one, you know, that's associated with Ronnie O'Sullivan or Judd Trump or Selby or Robertson, etc., etc. So that's the issue, really. It's how do you make more of the players rather than, you know, wearing do people really want to wear clothing with the branding of any sports body on? I don't know. I mean, it seems unlikely. You do see some people wearing them, and it is a keepsake. There are other things there. You can buy other sort of stuff as well. So it's not. It seems more going on than there was before. I'm sure that will increase because it is an area that I know they are looking at. So hopefully, in due course, there'll be more to buy. Now then, Tom Cull says, I'm a long-time listener and always appreciate the more trivial moments on the podcast. With this in mind, two things occurred to me, which may be too trivial to warrant your time. Listen, you obviously not listened to many episodes, Tom. It's all trivial. And I say that against myself, not any listeners. He says, the first is I have noticed that players often wear thick, heavy metal watches on their bridging hand. I remember as a boy playing on my own small table and ripping the cloth with my watch strap. Does this ever come up? And are the table fitters ever nervous about a player ripping the cloth when getting down on a shot? Well, I haven't seen that happen with a watch, but I mean, the table fitters, I'm sure, are watching closely. But Marco Fu had that extraordinary watch that time, didn't he? It was like Big Ben on his wrist. But it's not happened yet. He said the second was when I was at the theatre recently. While I was waiting for the show to start, my mind wandered and wondered if there'd ever been a play about snooker. Given the World Championship is in a theatre, perhaps that is an answer in itself. But I could imagine a play about snooker in the 1980s, perhaps. As a playwright yourself, have you ever thought about writing one? How could it be done? Well, Tom, there was a few years ago. It was at the Crucible. It was called The Nap. It was written by Richard Bean. It was directed by Richard Wilson, Victor Meldrew from One Foot in the Grave. I Don't Believe It and all that. It starred Jack O'Connell. It was a big deal, and it went to Broadway, actually. So it has been done. John Astley, they needed a snooker player in the play. He played the snooker player. And Ahmed Al-Sayed played the snooker player on Broadway. So it has been done. I did speak to someone at the Crucible about sort of a play about snooker, and they said they'd been, you won't be surprised, no, they've been offered a lot of them. And obviously, I think the other 50 weeks of the year, they kind of try and get away from snooker a little bit and concentrate on being what they are, which is a superb regional theatre. Now, I've had some follow-up on the Ronnie O'Sullivan Edge of Everything documentary. Not all of it serious, it's got to be said. Christine Clements says here, and this is her takeaway from the film, did you see the size of the tin of Quality Street Ronnie was eating from? Well, it's not exactly Barry Norman, but thank you for the observation, Christine. Now, but Matthew McConnell has watched it twice. And so he's got two emails based on the first and second viewing. So this interesting stuff. I'm going to read these out. He says, I was eagerly anticipating it. The early reviews hyped it up and it didn't disappoint. I really enjoyed it. As an avid Ronnie and snooker fan, I thought the best part of the film was probably the last 30 minutes or so when it focused on the World Semi and Final. This provided the best behind-the-scenes insight, in my opinion, and really felt like it was breaking new ground. The earlier parts are definitely going to be more interesting to the casual fan who needs the explainer of Ronnie's life. Although even within that, some great gems were uncovered, like Ronnie Senior's line of "Tell my boy to win" after his guilty verdict. The pressure that must have been heaped on his son's shoulders is unimaginable. Overall, a fantastic exploration of this amazing sportsman. I will mention some minor gripes I had with this film. One which has been mentioned by others, including perhaps yourself, is the lack of investigation of the referee incident in the World Final. The camera shot we get as Ronnie leaves the table is predominantly of his head and shoulders, so it's difficult to tell if there was any gesture made by Ronnie which Olivia Martil picked up on, or if it was a misunderstanding. Surprise on Ronnie's face does imply he had no idea what the ref was talking about, but it's left very open-ended. I'll jump in there and say two things, Matthew. The first is, I was in the arena that day, I didn't see any gesture. But the second thing I would say is, you do hear, and it's a fact, it's on the film, you do hear O'Sullivan swearing in the arena. Under his breath, it's picked up by the microphone, so it's sort of amplified. But you can be warned for that. If a referee hears that, and Matt Selt, I think, in the first round against Mark Selby, was actually warned for that. So that you can actually be warned for that. Now, I don't think that's what Olivia was talking about when he went over to speak to him. But, you know, that complicates it a little bit, I would say. We continue with Matthew says, the second thing I'd say is that I was a little disappointed they didn't include the 2021 World Grand Prix and the 2022 Tour Championship in the film, as I felt they were the most important tournaments that season for O'Sullivan. In the World Grand Prix, he won his first title for quite a while, beating Robertson in a rare game where he was considered the underdog. To me, that was a significant victory, and I'm surprised it wasn't mentioned. It also demonstrated some of Ronnie's genius in that he was on the rack for much of the match and still able to flip the switch and produce magic out of nowhere to win. Shame this wasn't illustrated to the viewers and they also foreshadowed events on the final day of the World Final. The Tour Championship later that season was also important because it was the first sign that O'Sullivan was properly in the form for a crack at Sheffield after his two fantastic performances against Williams and Robertson. I thought it might have been a nice stopping point on the way to telling the tale of the World Championship. I presume they simply had to cut stuff for time, or they felt the Scottish Open and Masters served the film better thematically, narratively, or they simply had more coverage from those events. I think actually, Matthew, it's just they didn't actually film every event with him. So I'm not sure they're actually at the World Grand Prix or the Tour Championship. It literally comes down to that. Obviously, they have other things that they're doing, and they have to sort of choose when to film and build the story from that. So it may that just have been they didn't have any footage. He says, finally, I thought we could have seen a small bit more of the actual matches here and there, i.e. proper top-down views of the table to show some of Ronnie's best shots or tell the story of the match a little more completely for casual fans. However, these are tiny critiques. I loved it. It's probably not the last time I'll watch it. If you have Prime, it's a no-brainer to view it. If you don't, it's worth paying the subscription. Well, just on that, we'll come to this in a minute because we've had an email from America, but it seems you can only actually watch it at the moment on Amazon Prime in the UK and Ireland, which obviously is not ideal. But we'll come on to that shortly, because Matthew, having watched it the first time, then watched it a second time. And you don't hear this in film reviews. You know, you hear Mark Kermode giving his latest on, I don't know, Saltburn or something. But you don't hear him coming back the next week and saying, I've watched it again, and this is now my second review. You just get one review. So this is a different thing. So Matthew's watched it again. He said, I've watched it a second time. It was as enjoyable as the first, if not more so. I've changed my mind on the amount of actual snooker they decided to show from the top-down view. I actually think they got the balance right with that one on second viewing. It's not really about that aspect of things in the end. Secondly, I appreciated their selection of the Scottish Open and Masters more than the first time. I heard an interview with Sam Blair, the director, where he mentioned that when they began working with Ronnie, he had distanced himself from the emotional side of the sport and wasn't super invested in winning the way he was by the end of the documentary. After hearing that, I saw this much more the second time, even though I'm sure a lot of people picked up on it straight away. The Scottish Open illustrates the distance from the sport, where he mentions not really being that annoyed at losing to Higgins and the fact he's very chilled out prior to the matches. The Masters shows the bug has bitten him a bit, again as he expresses some nerves before the tournament and says it's one of the few times recently where he wishes he was still playing in the tournament after losing to Robertson. This then culminates in the World Championship, where he's in a great mental turmoil as he becomes fully immersed in wanting to perform and win. While I still think the inclusion of the World Grand Prix and Tour Championship would have been nice, I definitely see the rationale for the tournaments they picked more clearly. It shows the progression of his investment in winning and toll that takes him on, and the toll that takes on him excellently. Thank you, Matthew. That's brilliant, actually. Very interesting to hear, you know, two sides there of the same coin, which is your views based on a second viewing. The film has got a lot of good feedback, I think, from within snooker, a lot of people talking about it, and most of the comments I've heard have been positive, including my own, I reviewed it last week. But it's not all good news. We've got Dave Daly here now. Of course, he is from the Ox Billiards Club in Seattle, and he says, it's time for another little rant about snooker being too UK-centric, despite the growth in China and other parts of the world. I've been looking forward to seeing the Ronnie documentary for ages, and was thrilled when it was announced it would be on Amazon Prime on the 23rd of November. It was exciting to see pundits mention how good it was and how it should help in marketing the sport further. I got up early on the day, Seattle being 8 hours behind the UK, to some text from UK friends saying I had a cameo in it. I show up in the front row of the final against Trump when Trump comes back to 14-11. In any case, I turned on Amazon Prime and, lo and behold, there was no Ronnie documentary listed. I then went to Amazon.co.uk and tried to stream it from there. It told me it was region restricted and only available in the UK. I have friends in Australia and Canada who also woke up to the disappointment of the documentary not being available in their region. Needless to say, with a bit of resourcefulness, I was able to find and watch it through some less than legal means. But it took time, it was a hassle, and I had to watch it on a PC instead of a big TV, which was my original plan. So much for marketing the sport. The casual snooker fan or someone new to snooker outside of the UK would have no chance of stumbling across it and gain some interest in the sport. I really don't understand the continued dichotomy of espousing snooker to be a global sport and then continue to focus on the UK market at the detriment of others. It's a shame and another missed opportunity. I'm guessing that Amazon only bought the rights to the UK market. I'd have to assume it's available in China through some other broadcast rights, but could be wrong. These are the things that need to be fixed if snooker ever has a chance of making it to the Olympics, etc. Anyway, rant over. I hope you're keeping well. I'll see you in April 2024. My flights to Sheffield are booked. Well, that's great to know, Dave, that bit is, apart from all the rest of it. Yeah, I mean, in terms of, obviously, this is not nothing to do with the snooker authorities. This is down to the filmmakers, the distributors. I'll get the word right. And you know, Amazon have picked up the rights, as you say, in the UK and Ireland, not elsewhere. I guess it doesn't mean it won't be available elsewhere, but when and where, I couldn't say. But it's a fair point in general. We are a UK-centric sport still, really. Maybe you could argue European-centric, and obviously China is a massive place, but there are many other parts of the world. And we found this out last week. I was doing the Judgment Day commentary, and so many of the messages we got were great messages from people in North America and Australia and various parts of the world where they do struggle to find live snooker and enjoy it, and they were able, of course, to do that on the World Snooker Tour Facebook and YouTube pages for free, and seem to really kind of appreciate that opportunity to do that. And we need to, you're quite right, we need to make sure that as much snooker content is as available to as many people around the world as possible. So it's unfortunate that this film at the moment is not. Hopefully that will be resolved soon and everyone can enjoy it. I think we'll do one more, and then, as I say, we'll be back later in the week for more. What has now become a two-part special. Whether it's special is for other people to judge. Anyway, Paul Regan writes, he says, first, if getting through this email feels a bit more Thorburn than Rocket, I apologise. Second, thanks for the words in all the formats that you provide for our sport. It really is much appreciated. Well, thank you, Paul. That is appreciated by me. He says, I'm a long-time pub pool player who fairly recently moved from London to Somerset and couldn't quite believe the number of local village halls that hide a snooker club. I joined one and have slowly been drawn back into our maddeningly difficult big table game. Like many who orbit your friendly and insightful podcast, nostalgia fuels my interest. I have vague childhood memories of the 85 final and various of Jimmy White's World Championship attempts. Dad bought us a 6-foot table for the front room. We got tickets to local exhibitions with the stars of the day that weren't too hungover to turn up. I'm not going to read that out, actually, because it may be libelous, the next sentence. Anyway, he says, snooker was also often on the telly when Grandad would visit. YouTube makes reliving these moments easy, as I've been learning the intricacies of snooker to improve my own game. I've been rewatching epic frames and matches from those golden decades. Gradually, my searches for highlights have moved forward through the fallow years where I turned away from the sport, from the rise and rise of the class of 92, through to relative newcomers like Trump, who, it turns out, cut his teeth a local club not far from me. Naturally, I've now ended up with a Discovery subscription to monitor the modern championships. It's striking to me how much TV punditry has changed during the years. True, there's a certain fondness for the fresh-faced David Icke in the days before his shape-shifting lizards arrived and took over the world with 5G phone masts, while Ted Lowe's trademark gravelly whisper still seems as synonymous with the sport as Ebony Ash and Green Bays. But let's be honest, the cast of commentators in those days did little more than simply describe what we could all see with our own eyes, often leaving long pauses for the crowd to fill, the coughing and throat-clearing typical of the Embassy and Benson and Hedges tournament years. As the years advanced, so too did the knowledge behind the microphone. Perhaps it's because more players brought their voices as they retired. Maybe it's just that good commentators, like yourself, now strive for a deeper understanding of the game. More time is taken to discuss strategy and match play, giving the viewer a clearer insight into the minds of those holding the cues. The best pundits also have the ability to zoom out mid-match and provide historical context too. Some, and Mr. Hendry, you're forgiven, even research the players we're all watching. So my question is this, what might we be missing out on right now? We've come this far with describing the game since the golden age of telly snooker. What happens in 20 or 30 years' time when we activate our VR implants to rewatch that classic 8th O'Sullivan World Championship victory from back in the 2020s? What new techniques might be making the commentary of today seem outdated or lacking? Or have we already reached the peak of your profession? One final thought. The obvious answer to this is analytics from virtual reality Hawkeye-type systems. And maybe that's the conclusion we draw. But this is more of a question about the craft of your vocation than it is about technology, which, given the views you've already aired on what we might call paralysis through over-analysis, may come as a relief. And, of course, none of this is in any way criticism. Your punditry, just like the podcast, is a peerless companion to the sport. Please do keep up the good, great work. Paul, that's very kind. It's a big question, I think. I mean, what I would say is sports commentary in general, so let's keep it across all sport, it has evolved to a degree, but it's basically still the same. You know, you look at football, it's still the sort of the match caller sitting alongside a player who adds technical insight. You know, I mean, cricket on the radio the sort of cast of voices and the diversity of voices has changed, but it's essentially the same thing. It's describing each delivery and then adding interesting insights in between. Horse racing is still about calling home the horses in order, as it is with an athletics race. You know, golf commentary, I guess, has become a bit more analytical and technical, and I think that's maybe what's happened in a lot of sports. Tennis, at Wimbledon in the 80s, you know, you'd see a great shot and dear old Dan Maskell would sort of say, "Ooh, I say," and that was kind of it. Whereas now, it's a lot more kind of analytical. Now, whether viewers want too much of that or whether they feel they have enough of it depends on the individual. Some people want a lot of that. Some people just want to kind of be left alone to enjoy what they're watching. In terms of how it can change, I mean, I think you're talking, I don't know whether you're talking specifically about commentary or the general punditry, because they're different. Commentary, I think, probably will not change that much. I think it will continue to be essentially what it's become, which is a mix of analysis of shots, context of what's happening, and hopefully an informative sort of guide to the match for the viewers. Side punditry, I think, has changed a bit. We see now on Eurosport, Alan McManus and Neil Foulds are both excellent at the touchscreen. They're analysing specific moments in frames and in matches, explaining why the shots are being played, how they're being played, maybe how they could have been played better. But identifying key moments rather than just sort of general analysis, actually picking out and explaining key moments. And Jimmy White, I mean, it's sort of it's kind of become a fun part of the broadcast. But actually, when he physically demonstrates how the shots are played, I think that's really valuable. You've seen it played in a match, then Jimmy takes a bit of time to explain how to play it and has a go himself, and sometimes he gets them, sometimes he doesn't. It's not about that. It's about actually just trying to explain to people, you know, why these shots are being played and how they're being played. So I think maybe away from the sort of the matches, when the matches are not on, maybe it will advance a little bit, and I guess technology would come into that, and who knows what's to be invented and how that could work, and maybe there'll come a time when, you know, you could almost sort of mock up someone actually playing a shot that's been played in a match, kind of almost in the match themselves. You know, there's all sorts of technology that is available and will become available. But I suppose the question is, does it become overkill? I mean, when I grew up watching sport, there was a programme called Grandstand on Saturday afternoons, okay, and people remember that fondly. And it was a sports kind of magazine, and you would have 20 minutes of table tennis, you'd have half an hour of boxing, you'd have 40 minutes of snooker, there might be highlights of basketball. There'd be all sorts of sports, and essentially it was just, that's what you got. And it wasn't hyped up, and it wasn't over-explained. You saw it, and then you moved on. And there was a lot to be said for that. And to a degree, I guess you get that in the Olympics now, on a sort of bigger scale. How much analysis people want, I don't know. I think some people would be fascinated to know the ins and outs of every shot played, and other people, frankly, just want to be left alone to enjoy a nice game of snooker. So I suppose the answer, Paul, is everyone's different, but I think you're right yourself. You identify that technology will be the way things move on, and things will move on, and it'll be interesting to see exactly in what direction. I will do one more because it's from regular correspondents, Mark and John, and it's actually on a similar theme. He says, they say, while commentating, do you make a conscious effort to hide any bias of the person you most like to win, or are you genuinely completely neutral? We've never been able to tell if you're supporting a particular player, and as fans, we find it hard to imagine how you wouldn't support certain players. Secondly, we're thinking about... Well, I'll come back to that, because you say, secondly, we're thinking about things we change in snooker. If we had three wishes from the snooker gods, we're calling it our light-hearted snooker triple wish list. Number one, a limit on the amount of snookers that can be played for at the end of the frame, maybe three. There's been a lot of talk about this. I actually heard a great suggestion. I think it came from Steve Davis, but Joe Perry was telling me about it. He actually said, the one thing no one's ever considered, you just get rid of the free ball. Because if you get rid of the free ball, they're not going to play on the last red if they're 40-odd behind, because it's very unlikely. If you're 50 behind on the last red and there's no chance of a free ball, that probably solves that one. I'm not saying I agree with it, and actually I'm saying I don't agree with it, because I don't really want the game changed, but that's an idea that kind of I've never heard before. Anyway, number two, return of the entertainer song at the end of a tournament while showing various flukes and funny moments. Funny enough, we were watching today, I was watching it with Sean Murphy, you won't mind me saying, on his phone, various montages from days gone by. The Barbra Streisand, Way We Were, we watched that one, we watched The Queen, Days of Our Lives, and we were kind of saying it'd be great if those came back. because they were quite emotional watches, actually. You see old faces and you have your memories of when you were watching that as it was broadcast. You know, we're talking over 30 years ago. Ray Stubbs, of course, did The Way We Were. He cut that together when he was a producer. But anyway, that's the entertainer, slightly different. But yeah, I mean, they were good fun, and they're all on YouTube. And number three, we'd like to see Jamie Clark and David Grace get into the top 16. They're both lovely people who we've met outside the venues and always have time to say hello or chat. Does anyone else have a light-hearted snooker triple wish list? It might be a fun new segment in the run-up to Christmas. Mark and John there, but they ask at the start, and do please get in contact, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, if you do have anything to add to that. But they ask at the start, do I make a conscious effort to hide any bias? I don't make any effort, for a simple reason. I don't have any real bias towards anybody, and I mean that. I know that sounds, oh, people say, oh, of course you do. But let's be clear, there are snooker players who I prefer watching compared to some other snooker players. There are snooker players who I would prefer to spend time with compared to other snooker players. But when the match is on, it's a game of snooker, and you have to show respect to both players. And the only real performance I'm interested in is my own. There's always going to be a narrative to whoever comes through. There's always a reason why someone winning is good for them, beyond just winning a match or winning a tournament. There'll be something in the background, and that's what you have to hone in on, you know, when you're commentating. I don't have favourites. I just don't. I don't support anybody. I'm always happy, you know, if a certain player wins, like Anthony Hamilton when he won the German Masters. That was brilliant, you know, because we've kind of known him a while and like him, and actually interviewed him at that tournament on the podcast. But as the match was going on, I had to show respect as well to Ali Carter, who was his opponent, and I would have been happy for him, because for another reason, that would have been good for him. I think it's very important, and Clive was the absolute master of this, of course, as he was at most things, Clive Everton. It's very important to take a sort of solid journalistic approach to it. You are there to commentate on the match. It's nothing to do with you who wins and loses, and you have to keep that for credibility's sake, I think. So I'm pleased to hear you say you don't pick up any bias, because it's not that I try not to show any. I genuinely do not have any. I don't care who wins or loses, really, until it's over, and then it becomes a great story. But I suppose the professional thing to do is just get sort of engrossed and caught up in the match. And yeah, that hopefully sort of comes across. And it's also important to say off-table things shouldn't come into it either. You know, it's not about whether that player's, you know, some misogynist, or whether that player voted Brexit or whatever it is. It doesn't matter. They're playing snooker and you're commentating on a snooker match, and it's about what's happening in that arena at that time. That's all you should be focused on. And I can't speak for anyone else, but when I'm commentating, I'm not supporting anybody. I'm trying to do the job that I've been paid to do and do it professionally. Obviously, sometimes you get moments that you get caught up in. Jimmy White last year qualifying for the UK. There's no doubt you understood what that meant to so many people, so you have to reflect that. But it's nothing to do with me. I'm just an observer, you know, and that is how you have to be. And thankfully, that's been my approach really ever since I started. We'll leave it there. We're back with more. So if you haven't heard your email read out, it will be, and you can still send them in, of course, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. I'm going to get back over for the evening session. I've got to say as well, the World Snooker Tour have done a fantastic job with the event again this year. I actually think it looks better than last year. I thought it was great last year, but the set is fantastic. Really modern looking. You know, that the backstage is good. It's a great venue, it's a great tournament, and the prestige of the UK Championship has definitely been restored with the format change last year, with what's been thrown at it. I guess the only thing you could say about that is it'd be nice to think that this could be thrown at other tournaments as well. I absolutely understand why so many resources are thrown at the big tournaments, you know, the big three, I suppose we're talking about. The problem is, in comparison, sometimes some of the other tournaments can look a little bit kind of faded, and that's the problem. You're comparing, you know, maybe a Home Nations or one of those events to one of these big tournaments, you can see the difference. So I guess the challenge now is to build up the other tournaments and build up the circuit full stop. But I think they're exciting times, actually, at the moment. We've got sort of rumours about other potential tournaments next season, and we'll see what happens with those. But there's a good feeling backstage. I mean, there may be some problems coming with the players' contracts and all that, and we'll no doubt to address that nearer the time, whether the players are going to sign it and what it means if they don't and all the rest of it. But to be honest, I'm not interested in spending the UK Championship talking about that. We're here to focus on the snooker. It's been a great start to the week, and we'll reflect more later in the week in part two. So for now, thanks for listening. Enjoy the coming snooker attractions. And as we always say, until later in the week, goodbye-bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.